pain has a face. Allow me to show it to you. Gentlemen, I am pain.
Here's Johnny.
I see dead people.
I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes.
Have you checked the children?
Have you checked the children?
You are one of us, Michael!
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
When there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
Good morning, Vietnam, and happy Halloween, dear listener. Welcome to our first ever extra special Halloween installment here at Play It Again, Kyla. I could not be more excited about the film that's going to be discussed today. Actually, it's not really a film. It's a television special, but it is a television special, which is a spoof of a film. So I think it qualifies for discussion here at Play It Again, Kyla. And of course, I am talking about the Scooby-Doo Project. Now, the Scooby-Doo Project is a phenomenon of mythic proportions for people of my generation, for children of the late 90s. This special aired once on Halloween night in 1999 as a way to promote a Scooby-Doo marathon over on Cartoon Network, and it terrified children of my generation. And now it's got somewhat of a cult following through appearances on YouTube and Reddit and Tumblr. You know, different posts about the special have gone viral in recent memory, and I just really felt like this was a good discussion to be had here on this show, especially with my returning guest for this evening, which is going to be none other than Ryan. Ryan is my resident Scooby-Doo expert of a guest. We really enjoy diving into the nitty-gritty of the Scooby cinematic universe, as we like to call it. And so I just really felt like it was time to discuss, you know, why this special is of mythic proportions to people who saw it, what it is that makes Scooby-Doo and Blair Witch each individually and then together so rife for spoofing, what makes a good spoof, and just really just talk about what was so scarring about watching the Scooby Project. So I hope that you have seen the Scooby-Doo Project. If you have not, hop on over to YouTube. You can watch it in a quick 17 to 21 minutes, depending on what version you find. I recommend the 21-minute version, which is the full version with the additional ending added on at the end. So watch that version if you can, and then pop back over here to hear this discussion, which is going to be definitely a lot longer than 17 to 21 minutes. If I had to guess, Ryan and I could talk. We can talk a lot. Our fellow UHPers from our time at GW are very aware of that. So buckle up, because it's going to be a bumpy and long ride, but it's going to be a fun one. So without further ado, let's go ahead and dive on in, shall we?
This was supposed to be just another mystery in the woods.
Have you heard these woods are haunted?
You kids stay away! Those woods are cursed! I never go near them!
Like, I bet she never goes near a dentist either.
We were cocky. Why shouldn't we be?
Don't forget, it's my turn to pull off the mask.
But then we got lost. In over our heads.
Wait a minute, I found a clue. Footprints.
No, those are our footprints. Those are our footprints.
Was the curse real?
Will someone go out there for a Scooby snack? Somebody? Anybody?
Maybe this time we shouldn't have meddled. We shouldn't have meddled.
So here today to contribute during our extra special Halloween episode of Play It Again, Kyla, is a special returning guest, Ryan. Introduce yourself, Ryan.
Hello. What to say? I mean, as Kyla said last time, I hold the distinction of being the best worst conversationalist you will ever talk to. I am extremely idiosyncratic. I cannot have any dairy products or beef. My medical history is rife, and I am a secret Scooby-Doo fanatic.
I feel like it's not so secret anymore. First of all, that's my favorite intro I've gotten this entire podcasting experience, because I love that you noted your dairy and beef aversion. Good for
you. Yes, they are. I mean, look, for someone else, they might be but instrumental to one's life. That is not the case for me. I think you look at me or hear me and you can tell. It's in the kind of primordial ether that underpins this world that you can know, oh yeah, this kid has a dairy allergy.
I want to make mention, Ryan, I don't know if you remember this, but the first time I saw you post freshman year, we ran into each other the summer after freshman year when I was living in Mark Rakowski's West Hall dormitory, and you had come to speak to incoming freshmen for CI. Rest in peace, CI.
And rip in peace, in peace.
I was holding a giant gallon of 2% milk when we ran into each other. And I was like, Ryan, this just feels like such a metaphor of a moment here.
Yes, it did scare me. I can't lie. Although I will say I've had kind of run-ins in the past. One time when I was younger, I was driving in a car, and I just have this very distinct memory. We stopped at McDonald's. We were going to some family reunion. It was my aunt and uncle's car, and then milk was tilted back, and the car jerked, and milk spilled all over me, and it was like hot acid was poured on me. Not in the feeling, of course, but just in the sense that it felt like I was a demon that had been like doused with holy water and driven away with iron. Like, I just started wailing. And so, yeah, it does not escape me the threat that you dairy drinkers pose. But my day will come, I assure you, when the environment rises up and destroys the beef industry, when the cows refuse to sow the milk fields any longer, then my day will come.
So 2 points to that, Ryan. Number one, so for anyone listening, aka the only person who's going to listen to this entire episode, Mary, the light of my life, no longer Rothmitch, now yes. Mary Corey. If you want to exorcise Ryan from your life, milk products are the way to do it.
Well, thankfully, I was able to get it so that I can't be exercised anymore, but yes.
Okay. And number two, Ryan, when I eventually do an episode that I will inevitably do on the documentary Eating Animals about the effects of factory farming, will you come on as my guest?
I will, actually, because that's a very complicated thing for me. I eat turkey a lot instead, because I can't have beef. And so I was thinking about this with a vegetarian friend the other day, and the friend was basically talking about, it was three friends, one's a meat eater, one's a vegetarian, one was me. And the meat eater was like giving their kind of obligatory defending themselves insecurely to a vegetarian, sort of. And the vegetarian is like, no, it's okay. Like, I understand, you don't have to. And I was just thinking out loud, as I do. And I said, yeah, you know, like, I feel like I already do make a pretty big contribution because I don't eat beef or milk. And then I paused and I said, but then again, that's not really any effort for me because I have to do it anyway. So does that really mean anything at all? And then,
does that count as a contribution at that point?
Does it really count when I can just do it? So it'll be a complex moral journey for me.
All right. So it's coming soon to Play It Again, Kyla, near you, a discussion on eating animals featuring Ryan. That'll be my first documentary episode if I do that before any other documentaries. Okay. So now that we are 5 minutes into this conversation and have not yet mentioned the film of the hour, I think it bears mentioning, even though for those of you who are sitting at home listening, you can glance at the episode title and know that we are here to discuss the seminal Cartoon Network classic, The Scooby-Doo Project.
Yep.
I'm holding for applause.
Yep. Just, yes, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. What is this film,
Kyla? So, Ryan... What is this film? Does it qualify as a film? I think it does.
Yes.
Before we question the nature and the categorization of this film, though, Ryan, I do want to get your answer to a few spooky season specific getting to know you movie questions.
Yes.
Okay? So my first question for you to put us all in the spooky mood that is needed to fully wrestle with the implications of the Scooby-Doo project is, what is your favorite spooky film, Ryan?
Oh, now this is hard because I don't watch a lot of horror movies. I'm very selective because I can get really scared. I get scared really easily and it just gets me. So I don't watch modern horror movies, not because I have some shallow argument about jump scares or whatever, but genuinely just because I can't handle them. So I'm trying to think horror movies. Well, Alien is a spooky movie. Definitely my favorite. One of my favorite films, Scream as well. So those are two spooky movies. If we're talking spooky movies, where spookiness is a theme, present, then I was trying to kind of trawl through my favorite Halloween specials as a kid to remember what it would be. I would say probably Ghostbusters. Or, now here I'm going to dig in deep to some esoteric lore. Oh, Adam's Family Values, of course. I just watched that the other night, but that's not the lore. The deep esoteric lore is one of the Cartoon Network Halloween specials. Scary Godmother. Are you familiar?
Oh, you just accessed something so deep in the recesses of my brain. Ryan, where did you pull this from?
Yes, like... the Scary Godmother Halloween Spooktacular. It is a it's based on a book in a series of comic books. I didn't know that until I looked at the Wikipedia page the other day. I'm also a fan of The Scary Godmother 2, The Revenge of Jimmy. It is a Cartoon Network animated 3D special. The animation style I would describe as bowling alley strike animation quality. You know, bowling alleys that do that. It is something. It just gets me in that mood. You know, it's just it is. It's a little scary, but it's just fun, and it just quenches that nice spot.
Well, I feel like you answered my follow up question already with your Scary Godmother soliloquy there, which was, I was going to ask, what is the movie or viewing experience that always puts you in the Halloween spirit?
Yeah, definitely that one. I mean, I think that like Halloween I love the je ne sais quoi, the je ne sais quoi of fall and of Halloween. And I do, of course, like films like Halloween Town and such productions. But I think that, and I haven't seen Scary Godmother in a long time, but I feel like it says something that it's the one that really sticks out as just good. As just the power of Halloween.
I'm disappointed that when we had a Halloween movie night that we planned for the honors program, we did not put Scary Godmother on the table as a possibility.
I think I might have argued for it. it seemed like the kind of thing I would do. Or Halloween Town 2, Calabar's Revenge, which is, you know, a pretty good one.
That's what I wanted. We ended up watching Halloween Town 1, which is good, but I think
I like how the lore develops in Halloween Town 2, Calabar's Revenge.
Me too. I'm a fan of Gwen's romance with Calabar contributing more to the plot.
Mm-hmm. Plus kind of, I have this weird thing. I have a lot of idiosyncrasies again. But one of them is that, I don't like pilots and like pilot episodes of things, or like if I know something really well, I don't like to read introductions or you know, basically I don't like to go to the introduction of any media very much if I already know it super well. So, you know, I watched Halloween Town 2 so many times that to like go watch Halloween Town 1, I was like, this basic garbage.
That, you know, I've never heard anyone actually say aloud like that they personally have like an aversion to introductory media, but I feel like I have that too. But the way that mine exhibits itself is that if I know, this is so strange, I can't believe I'm admitting this out loud, but if I know that a central couple is going to get together. I don't like watching the media prior to their getting together.
Oh, totally. I know what you mean. I think, and this doesn't happen with stuff that is, you might hear some rustling. I'm moving to a place where I have a better connection. This is, you're seeing this live and in person, viewers. This is what we do in coronavirus times. Okay. I know what you mean though. I feel like, it just makes me feel unpleasant, especially if I've watched it, like The Office, or I don't really like watching The Office before Jim and Pam got together. Parks and Rec, I don't like watching before Leslie and Ben get together. All those shows that have a will they or won't they. Like, I just can't. I think partially it just feels like wasted time. I don't know. Maybe it's not that. It just makes me uncomfortable.
Me too. And that's, I feel like the vast majority of people would seemingly argue the opposite, because for a lot of people, like once the couple gets together, like the allure of the relationship is gone. But there's just something within me that I'm, like you said, I'm like, this is wasted time. We all know they're going to get together. Like, you established the slow burn dynamic, like speed it up a little bit, you know?
Yes. Yes. I mean, yeah, I think it's because it's like the melodrama being like kind of artificial sort of rears its head in that moment where you're like, I know what you always wanted the whole time. Or that's how I feel. Like, my least favorite moments in shows are when a couple breaks up, but you like, I know they'll get back together later. So this happens on like every show. So like Riverdale or Buffy, this happens. Just a lot of shows.
You made it 11, almost 12 minutes without mentioning Riverdale this time.
Okay, right? That's fine. That is okay. I'm okay to have, I'm like the chick stripped or the chick tracked, where it's like they hated Jesus because he told the truth. and because I've been watching a lot of bad TV and like goofy TV, and I promise nothing holds a candle to Riverdale. But nonetheless, it's the same sort of thing where it's like, I don't like watching artificial breakups and relationship conflict to begin with in shows. It annoys me, but I especially can't handle breakups when I know the characters are going to get back together.
No, I agree with you 1000%. It's interesting that you bring that up, though, because if we're going to discuss, like, within our umbrella discussion of the Scooby Project, if we're going to delve into, like, popular Halloween spoofs of episodic television of the 90s. I can't believe I'm mentioning this so early on, but like, we're gonna have to talk about the Boy Meets World episode, and then there was Sean.
We will have to do that, won't we?
We have to. It's a rule. And that episode, I love that episode, but you know what bothers me so much about it? The entire plot is generated supposedly from the tension that Cory and Topanga might not get back together.
That's true. I mean, I feel like that's so quintessential, because their will they or won't they is so much more long than like most others in TV. Like, it's like, well, that I know at least anyway, and that I like, where it's just like, I have to skip through Cory and Topanga melodrama episodes because I'm like, don't waste my time with this.
And the thing with Cory and Topanga is like, I feel like they're the one couple that we all knew from like episode 3, like they're going to get married. Like, there is no... won't they will, right? It's just a matter of time.
Yes.
So that's my qualm with And Then There Was Sean, which I'm sure will come back up later in our discussion,
but won't it.
My next question for you, Ryan, is what's the most scared you've ever been while watching a movie?
Oh gosh, okay, I have one example. I'm trying to think of, oh okay, two, I have three good ones. I'm trying to think of what they are. Okay, well, I'll just start. First has to be the live and in-person viewing experience. Finding Nemo. I am 4 years old, or 3 years old or whatever. I have the distinct memory of being there, watching the movie, getting really upset when the diver shows up, having to be taken out and not finishing the film. Because it just upset me so profoundly. So that's one. Two, I would say, was, I mean, good scare, probably an alien, but it wasn't so scary that I like couldn't watch. Then probably watching the trailer for Apollo 18 when I was when I was however many years old, watching Captain America, the First Avenger in theaters. Let's see how old I was.
The fact that that experience marked you so deeply that, like, you know what film you were there to see when that trailer came on. I am floored, Ryan.
It was, so I was 13. I didn't like horror movies then. I hadn't, like, watched Alien, which is now my favorite. And I was just, like, so spooked out by it. It was too much. Let me think. I feel like there was some additional one where it was just some, like, film about, like, Satanism or not that. Like, I didn't watch scary movies. Oh, probably the third cinematic horror experience would be reading the synopsis of Paranormal Activity and then looking up screenshots of it when I was probably 13 or 12 and getting really, really freaked out. And I was like, oh, I'm good. Like, I'm done. Like, take me now. I this is it.
I love that to you, Ryan, reading the synopsis on Wikipedia is, like, completely akin to actually the visual experience of watching the movie.
I get scared. I got unnerved reading the summary to Blair Witch Project the other day.
Did you really?
Yes. I was like, oh, this is really scary. And then I did, like, look up some screenshots, but I was like, oh, like, it was too much tuna for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My next question for you is, what's your favorite movie monster? And I feel like I know the answer to this already.
Oh, so many choices. Monster. Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, this is hard. I mean, the alien from Aliens is a classic. That's always because it's just such a spooky, scary skeleton. I mean, the monster, the diver from Finding Nemo, again, we can't discount that. The goat man from Pan's Labyrinth. Or, you know, I felt like is this favorite or scariest?
It's whatever you want to make the question, Ryan.
Okay, good. Well, I always have three answers for all of it anyway, as you can tell. I think every question you've asked me since I've appeared for the first time on this podcast, I've given three answers.
I think you have.
That's fine. Godzilla, you know, ranks among the best, the top, tip top. So Godzilla is probably my fave. When you're talking small, we'll do like D&D sizing. You know, if we're talking enormous, Godzilla. Huge, I don't have one for that. Medium, Alien. So that's the answer.
That's the answer. Okay. Mm-hmm. And my final spooky season getting to know you question, Ryan, which will help us transition into our discussion about the Scooby-Doo project. What do you think is the best Scooby scare?
That is absolutely Scooby-Doo and Monster Island. I didn't need a second to think about it. It was, I don't know if it was the first ever Scooby-Doo film where the monsters were real, but it was the first one that I saw where the monsters were real. And it was horrifying. I think also it taps into something that Clara, my lovely love, has pointed out to me, which is that, like, I think that for Catholics such as myself, there's a certain level of scare that comes in certain things, like with, say, witches and demons and ghosts, because it's like, it's because I'm like, it's real. Like, that's how I kind of feel. I mean, no offense if there is any people who are, like, Wiccans or anything, but, like, people who are Satanists specifically and who don't see it as, like, an issue, I'm like, nah, I can't mess with that. Or, like, we were watching BuzzFeed Unsolved the other night, and I was like, no, because it reminds me of the meme. I feel like it's the devil being like, am I a f***ing joke to you? So I'm not trying to mess with the devil or demons. So I'll get plenty scared by them because I know they're real.
I love, though, that to you, the animated villains of Scooby-Doo and Zombie Island basically are Satanists.
I mean, it's voodoo and they're zombies. And I was like, I thought of the final great scare experience. I'm going to derail myself. This is why this podcast is going to be 3 hours long. So did you ever watch the Rugrats spinoff, All Grown Up?
I did not.
Okay, so it's a horror episode. I'm Googling it right now. Basically, Rugrats had a spinoff called All Grown Up. It was about the kids when they were in middle school, high school. And there's an episode where they go to like a camp. One of the kids who Dill, the baby from Rugrats grown into a stoner kid, befriends, is named Bean. And it turns out at the end that Bean is like a ghost of a pioneer settler who died hundreds of years ago. So I'm always really spooked out by that kind of stuff where it's like something from hundreds of years ago and like it's a ruined settlement and like, ooh, like the ghost of the first pirates who came here or whatever, which is kind of what Zombie Island does. So I think that stuff spooks me out, which is why Scooby-Doo Monster or on Zombie Island gets me.
Back to like Zombie Island, though, I think that you're on to something in that I think that was a lot of people's first like truly scary Scooby-Doo experience. And I think that it's interesting that the making of that film was tied to the making of the Scooby-Doo project, which I'll talk about more in just a minute. But one thing about Zombie Island is that always strikes me is that it's discombobulating from the very beginning. Yes. Because it doesn't start out as your typical Scooby-Doo fair. You know, it's not they're all in the mystery machine bebopping up to this mysterious location where they encounter a friend who is somehow connected to this central mystery. Like, they're all scattered. They're all seemingly adults now. Like, they all have jobs. So, like, from the very beginning, you're like, oh, this is not the Scooby-Doo of my childhood.
That's what makes it, I think you're right. And I was just thinking of how that makes it more scary because it makes it grounded in this sense of realism, which like precipitates the scariness. Like in other Scooby-Doo stuff, even the one that I think is maybe the next scariest, which is the one where they go to with the New England warlock, whatever his name was, you told me it and I forgot way back when we, but where Velma like has her quasi romance with the dude who turns out to be a warlock. I find New England witch stuff to be scary as well, but see the Vivitch. But that didn't feel like they were adults. They still felt like they were somewhat children. And in this case, they were adults. It felt like it was real life and they were just as freaked out as us. The animation was a lot like, I mean, it looked really good. It didn't, it had a lot of shading. It was really dark in its color. It looked more like, honestly, kind of like an anime in some moments than like a traditional Scooby-Doo joint. It scared me.
And I think that you're right, though, because the realism, it adds to the effect when you ultimately find out that the villains are real at the end of Zombie Island. So, like, there's just realism throughout. So I think that that's why that stands in most people's minds. Because to me, that's the scariest.
I think the fact that it's also it draws in this like the weird kind of it was very, I mean, quite creative in terms of like what kind of horror and like supernatural stuff it draws from because of like. And what makes it so different to me is how it draws on like the supernaturalism of like voodoo and like Caribbean, especially in like Louisiana, New Orleans kind of culture, because that's very different from, not to be a literary historian about this, but the like witches in the supernatural in like in the kind of northern American context is really different because it's influenced by like the Puritans and with the, how they kind of located the supernatural. Whereas for stuff in New Orleans and like the Caribbean, it was a lot more related to like the interplay between like old world Catholicism and like voodoo religious practice through the Caribbean. And then the way that all kind of mingled together into this like very spoopy gothic kind of stuff in that jambalaya, if you will, of New Orleans. So anyway, it's the best.
Mm-hmm. In conclusion, it's scary.
Yes, I got spooked.
And I feel like it's really important that we're talking about Zombie Island, because not only is it technically linked to the Scooby-Doo project, it also, like, I feel like what the Scooby project does is it builds upon a lot of the foundations of scariness that we find in Zombie Island, because there is this thread of realism and of, like, referentialness to itself. Yes. Within the Scooby-Doo project, that I don't know if that would have worked if you didn't have the experimental nature of the storytelling in Zombie Island, because Zombie Island was like, let's test this out. Let's see if kids will follow and respond to a story that's not entirely formulaic. But yeah. The only reason it works in turning the formula on its head is because the formula is so well established. And yeah. I think that's the reason that Scooby Project works so well as a spoof. Yeah. Is because the formula was so well established that they were able to completely subvert all of our expectations from it. You know?
I think it really came in this, like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I'm going to talk about critical theory and Scooby-Doo. It really came about in this moment in the 90s where, like, there was this postmodern sensibility. Excuse me. In popular culture, and when it came to, like, the 30-year cycle of cultural memory, and, like, stuff from the 60s became very, like, I mean, I just only think of the number of like Warner Bros. And Hanna-Barbera properties that, like, made it into movies at the time. We talked about this last time, but the Flintstones movies, the Flintstones had a similar kind of I'll get to the Flintstones in a sec. But the Jetsons, they did the Brady Bunch movie. So I guess more like the 70s, but there was that, the 70s more accurately, that cultural memory of it, mixed with this desire to, like, deconstruct it, I guess, because the people who were now writing it, I have to assume, were of the age where they were the ones who watched it as children. I feel like that's got to be part of it. It reminds me of the Flintstones movie, the made-for-TV movie that always gets me, which was, like, I don't know what it was, but it was basically, like, the Flintstones 25 years in the future. Pebbles and Bam Bam are married.
Are you talking, is it Wedding in Rock Vegas?
Yes. Yes.
Changed my life.
So, like, yeah, for the, okay, the amount of Google specificity. There it is. No. This isn't it. It was an animated version. Are you thinking of an animated version?
I think so. They did a live action version where Pebbles and Bam Bam are married.
Well, this is the Flintstones in Viva Rocks Vegas. Okay, sorry. No, this is the prequel to the Flintstones movie. But it was, no, we're thinking of the same thing. It's basically like 20 years in the future, Pebbles and Bam Bam have gotten married. It's either in this one or there's a sequel. Bam Bam is, or Pebbles is pregnant. Fred is struggling because Wilma is getting involved in the community and has left him. He only has frozen dinners that are just, like, giant hunks of meat in ice blocks. And there's, like, the Rocks Vegas, like, sleazy record producer or something like that. Or actor, like, or like record, something like a manager in entertainment. You know what I'm talking about. I don't know why I brought this up. I guess because I needed to mention it. It felt like a similar kind of thing where it's like, let's make the Flintstones mature. Let's talk about, hey, when you're 50, your life kind of changes.
I see the comparison, Ryan. I really do. Why was this such a phenomenon at the turn of the millennium, though? Like, why?
Holly Rockabye Baby. That's what it was. I have to guess that it's because, again, I can only imagine for reasons beyond the fact that there was this, oh my God, I got this stuff in my throat. You got to edit that out. It's gross. Okay. Or don't. It's fine. I have to imagine that it's because, hey, Bill Clinton just got elected president. Yep. Okay. I Yabba Dabba Doo was in 1993 and Holly Rockabye Baby was in 1993 as well. Yeah. I got to think Bill Clinton's elected president, Soviet Union just fell. It's the end of history. All the kids who watched these shows in the 60s are now the creators at Hanna-Barbera. They're just going to go wild with it. Money is endless. Recession? Nope. Don't got one of those. Monica Lewinsky? Don't know who she is. It's 1993. Baby, everything's good. So I think that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I have to note, though, as a child, I Yabba Dabba Doo was one of my favorite VHSs that I owned. I watched it.
Not shocking me.
Why?
I don't know. It just seems like the kind of esoteric thing that I'm like, oh, that makes sense. That would be your thing.
Well, let's go ahead, now that we've examined the theories surrounding the Scooby-Doo project, let's dive in and talk about the beast itself. Ryan, were you aware of the Scooby-Doo project before we spoke about it? Okay. So talk about your experience watching it for the first time.
So, like I said, just due to, I don't know, like the bug being in my ear, or whatever the expression is, I had been familiarizing myself with the Blair Witch Project the past few days. And, you know, just looking at the kind of impact it had on like movies, it was filmed like somewhat near where I live. It's 40 minutes or an hour away. I can totally, and so that, like, it was one of those movies where I read about it as a kid and I was like, I'm not messing with this. Similarly, it's another summary that scared me. And then I watch it and it was just like very unnerving, especially because like now I think of that genre of you're alone in the woods and something is stalking you, a la Slender Man or Blair Witch or the sequel to Blair Witch. It's just so much that I felt like just so unnerved as I was watching it, but yet like so amused by the, it felt like a commercial, not a commercial. What's the, yeah. Okay. So, you know, on Cartoon Network, 4 o'clock, they had the like programming block and it would be like their theme and it would be like whatever weird kind of like Toonami would be the late night one where it's just like the thing they have in between the shows that frames it, which I don't understand why that happened or why those existed. It's kind of like, okay, let me get into professional wrestling for a sec. Are you familiar with professional wrestling?
Yes, unfortunately.
Do you know the concept of the kayfabe?
I do not, Ryan.
The kayfabe, K-A-Y-F-A-B-E, is basically the phenomenon in professional wrestling where it is treated as real. And only on rare emergency occasions does anyone ever say, this isn't real, like this is fake. That's kind of what I feel like about those programming blocks, that like they were like, why is this robot man setting up the show that I'm about to watch? I don't need this. I understand that this is being broadcast from somewhere. Anyway, that's what the Scooby-Doo project felt like. It felt like it was like bits that they aired in between, they would air in between other shows.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what it was originally conceived of as, right. And that's how it was broadcast originally. Like in between episodes, but then they cut it together and broadcast it as one continuous project one time and then never aired it again.
Yeah, I can imagine why.
But what's interesting to me is it's I understand your comparison to the kayfabe, but I feel like it's somewhat the exact opposite in that these brief snippets are making the show that you had completely understood to be fake seem real, you know, like, yes. instead of taking something from like instead of something that we all know is not real, I don't know, like it just you've opened up this inception, like I'm just tumbling through this thing in my brain right now of like
this is the topic of my academic research, media and narrative framing, so I'm ready.
But like it's just, I don't know, like the fact that Scooby-Doo, I don't know, and the fact that it's so meta in acknowledging that this is like I said, the formula is so established. Like, Fred even has the line at one point where he's like, well, usually in 20 minutes, we solve everything.
I did like that one a lot.
And so, like, this movement from, whereas, I don't know, the idea of the realism, it's just, I don't know, it's so, I now want to fully examine the comparison with professional wrestling, Ryan.
Yep, what did you do? Right.
You've broken my brain.
That kind of, okay, now I've brought in professional wrestling. That was my Roland Barthes moment for all my literary scholars. Now I'll bring in another one. It was just this, if you want to break your brain less, it's just similar to the thing that, like, all those, a lot of, like, 19th century novels do, right? Where it's like, they feel like they need to explain how this book that you're holding actually refers to real world events. It wasn't just made up, like, as though, and not just that, but as though the thing you're reading was actually produced by someone, like how Dracula is like, these are real accounts taken from X, Y, and Z. And, like, you know what I mean? And the same way that the Blair Witch Project is like that, which to my knowledge is one of the first movies, definitely first popular movies that, like, did something like that, where there was, like, this worry. I mean, and then Paranormal Activity would do a similar thing later, even naming, I don't know, I don't remember if Blair Witch does this, but, like, Paranormal Activity has the actors have the same first names as the characters.
Yeah, Blair Witch did that.
Right. So it's that, like, kind of that level of it. But it's, like, very weird, but in this case it's this strange, like, uncanny valley, because obviously it's not real people. It's a Roger Rabbit situation where it's like cartoon people interacting with real environments and even real people at a certain point. And also it leads off with that, like, I don't even know what to make of it, where it leads off with, like, five children and their Great Dane went missing in the woods, or four, I mean.
To me, the promo is the most terrifying aspect of this entire thing. And there's the promo, which I don't know if you saw it, because as I acknowledged earlier, like, this has never been professionally released by Cartoon Network. Like, there's no DVD or anything. So you got to watch it on YouTube or, like, through links that you find on Reddit. And, There is a version that at the end plays one of the original promos, which features, like, Velma, like, narrating and being like, and it's just like, it's just like got clips from the special, but it's Velma talking about, like, how, like, they shouldn't have done this. And she's speaking directly into the camera, and it ends with, we shouldn't have meddled. We should not. And it still to this day, like, shakes me to my core.
Yeah.
It's so terrifying. Before we talk about the, like, what it is that makes this special so scary, I do want to give, like, a little bit of background information. As Ryan pointed out when I was talking to him about this earlier, I think that the origin story of the Scooby-Doo Project is the origin story of a lot of very interesting media, which is basically some interns / low-level staffers at Turner Animation at Turner Studios in Atlanta were tasked with making a promo for, there were going to be three different Scooby-Doo cartoon marathons broadcast on Cartoon Network at different times throughout the month of October in 1999. And so Cartoon Network was like, hey, we need promos for these. And so the three separate individuals or groups who had been tasked with that got together and were like, hey, what if we pooled our resources and made, like, one really good, really special promo? And they were like, you know, Blair Witch is really big right now. Let's do a Blair Witch spoof, as I think every television show in the late 90s was doing. In 1999, I think everyone had to do a Blair Witch spoof. Like, it's just, yes, it was a truth universally acknowledged that a television show with a good following must be in search of a Blair Witch spoof.
And yes.
So I don't know why Scooby-Doo had the best one, but it did, I think. And so they pulled their resources and they realized that they had basically no funding.
Yes, so, as per usual with Scooby-Doo productions.
Right. And it's isn't that though the appeal of a lot of the Scooby-Doo productions is that
yes,
like,
it is.
Doesn't look great. I love it. So anyways, the mystery machine, the live action mystery machine was somewhere in Canada. So they had to fly out producers to Canada, and that was like the entirety of their budget. So they literally used their own parents as the people being interviewed, and like the press conference scenes were shot in the break room of the Cartoon Network studios there in Atlanta. And like the people themselves were playing the roles. They got the voice cast from Scooby-Doo and Zombie Island to record their lines over the phone for this. So that's why it's technically connected to Zombie Island, because the actors are recording their lines for those two projects at the same time. It's such a crazy story that I really, you guys, there's been a lot of pieces written about this. One of the producers actually wrote up a huge thread on Reddit about like the making of.
Ooh, I want to listen. I want to read that.
Which I will link in the show notes for every one of you that are listening at home. But when
every one of you,
yes, Mary, this is for you. But so by the time that this was going to air, because it aired on Halloween 1999, there had already been a lot of Blair Witch spoofs, and Cartoon Network was a little nervous. They were like, how is ours going to land, like, now that everyone else has done this? But this is widely regarded by critics to be one of the best Blair Witch spoofs.
Yes.
And what's interesting, though, like you said, Ryan, like, it was aired with the little bumpers as lead-in promos for shows, and then it was cut together, but it never aired again after having been aired cut together, and it was never released on DVD. And so there was a lot of speculation in the early 2000s, like amongst viewers, who were like, did they never release it because it scared people? And an urban legend actually emerged that the reason Cartoon Network had never rebroadcast it or released it on DVD was because like parents called to complain because their children were so scarred by this. So that's where I want to begin our deep dive into the Scooby-Doo project with the question, why do you think that the Scooby-Doo project scarred so many children, Ryan?
Okay, so I don't know the technical details. I would love to read the what the producer said. I have a theory on part of why. I just looked on the calendar. I did a Google. So let me confirm it again. October 1999. Okay. So October 1999, what day is October 31st, 1999? It is a Sunday. So that means that barring homework, and I don't know how many school districts are like this. My school system is the day after Halloween is a day off. So it's like technically for professional development for teachers so they can do grades and stuff, but it like coincides. So maybe it's like that other places, maybe it's not, but regardless, it's Sunday. So that means, barring homework, you are able to watch this monstrosity the whole day until you go trick-or-treating. If you are one of those kids who's not allowed to go trick-or-treating, or if it's raining, then you are watching this. And so I feel like the fact that it happened on a weekend, depending on what time of day this aired, I mean, this couldn't have been done, I have to imagine, on a weekday Sunday or a weekday Halloween, because so many fewer kids would have watched it. I have to think. And so I feel like that's probably part of it, why it had this huge smash success. Why was it so scary? It's scary. It takes all of the... it has this very David Lynchian quality, because it takes all the imagery from Blair Witch, but as I remember, I could be wrong, but I don't remember there was a reference to like the stuff with the Blair Witch of like being in the corner, like there was in the movie. And so there's this weird quality to it where, first of all, you're a kid in 1999. Maybe you know what the Blair Witch Project is. Even more unlikely, maybe you've seen it. So then there's this all these weird moments and imagery that's just like really eerie, unnerving, and you don't know what it references, and it's just like there. I feel like part of the scariness is the epistemological horror of it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I had never considered the fact that this was broadcast on a weekend for the first time, and I think that you're absolutely right that that's why so many people remember this, because like how many little bumper promos from Cartoon Network do you actually remember vividly? Like, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say none other than
well it depends what person you're talking to. That's if you're true. Talking to me, that's I can assure true. You it's a lot.
But I feel like this one transcends all of those usual expectations because it was so striking, and maybe it was bolstered in its strikingness because of when it aired.
Yes.
So I agree with you there that I think it airing on a weekend was probably very important. And I think that there is something so unnerving about seeing these animated characters inhabiting a real environment. Like that automatically, like your brain's like, this is wrong. What are we processing here? And then on top of that, the thing that unnerves me the most, though, the visuals, yes, they can be scary. But if I close my eyes, I think it's even scarier, because I don't think that I've ever actually heard the Scooby-Doo gang's voices convey genuine distress.
Except in Zombie Island, yes.
Yeah. But for the most part, it's like, it doesn't matter how dire the circumstances, how scary the monster, like, it's, everything's okay. Like, you know, and their voices never tremble or show, like, emotion other than, like, humor for the most part.
Yes.
And so to hear Daphne's voice quake, and like Velma be genuinely terrified that she's not going to be able to outsmart this villain, like, it just, there is something so deeply unnerving and discombobulating about that, where you're like, this is just wrong. Again, my brain doesn't know how to process this.
Yeah. Yes. I think especially, like, that's the funny transformation of, I mean, I just think of the image of Shaggy in the corner, as ridiculous as it looks. When you don't have context for that, it's just, like, so hauntingly strange, which is why I call it, like, Lynchian, where it's just, like, there is no setup for why you're in the red room chewing the gum and, mm-hmm. like, talking to Laura Palmer, or why this monster man is climbing over the couch. It's just, like, there. And I feel like that's kind of the effect of this, too. Not to mention, like, the POV, the perspectival filming, if you will, the actual Blair Witch stuff that happens, the interpersonal arguments between the characters.
Right. To hear everyone actually sound angry with each other is another, like, major discombobulating factor. Like, when they're all ganging up on Velma, like, I was like, what is this? What's happening to my nice little family, you know?
Yes. Yeah, it's, I mean, again, a level of discord that we have not yet seen. We have not seen since the Scooby-Doo 1 original production. It also, the zombie is just like, again, the fact that it's not particularly like, it's like, what is it? It's just this creature, you know? Mm-hmm. And let's see, I'm trying to remember if there's specific details. I mean, basically just a monster is haunting the woods. It's not like the ooze monster or the
they don't even know what the monster is, because as Velma points out, all of the stories they're getting from the townspeople are different.
Right.
So, like, it's not like there's one central big bad that they can unmask. Like, there's just something wrong in this general area, you know?
Right. And so it's not like it's it's not thematic to anything. And then you look at the miner, the monster, and it's just like it what is it? It looks like an alien, like a frog, like
creature, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of part of it too. Like, initially the Wikipedia synopsis describes it as a zombie, but if this cat is a zombie, I do not know what he was when he was alive.
It's It's an amalgamation of so many different terrifying monsters, you know?
And so, you don't see it, so it doesn't look that, like, that corny, like it ordinarily would. And then, like, when it's just got these long...
passing and stuff.
Right, especially when it's just got these long, long limbs. Uh-huh. Very interestingly, an echo of what the actual Blair Witch monster is in the 2019 sequel, Blair Witch, which, again, I've looked up the synopsis to and have seen clips with, of course, muted. I'm not watching that live, certainly no, but like, it looks kind of similar. It's funny.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you, Ryan, do you think this is the best Blair Witch spoof?
Yeah, you know, I feel like it probably is, because I think it, most Blair Witch spoofs, as with most movie spoofs, like, they can only get so much mileage out of the fact that they, like, making fun of the format or the medium or the work itself can only get you so far, which is why, like, most, I think you notice most parody films kind of, like, putter out towards the end, but, or even in the middle. But with this, like, it's kind of making a comment both on Scooby-Doo and on Paranormal Activity, on Blair Witch and on horror movies. And so it just got so much to work with that, like, all this stuff gets smushed together. So for that reason, like, they make fun of the Scooby-Doo format, but they also make fun of, like, the horror movie format, which is, I think, very useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think that it's the marriage of the concepts of spoofing Scooby-Doo and spoofing Blair Witch all wrapped into one that make this work so wonderfully well. Prior to my rediscovery of the Scooby Project here recently, if you had asked me what my favorite Blair Witch spoof was, I would have said, don't mock me, but I would have said the Dawson's Creek Blair Witch episode.
Yes, this makes sense.
I just deeply love that episode, even though it's not the greatest episode of television, but I love it as a Blair Witch spoof. But one thing I was struck by watching and researching the Scooby-Doo project is that this came out on Halloween in 1999, and the Dawson's Creek parody came out, I believe, on November 11th.
I bet they kicked themselves.
And so I'm just like, the fact that Scooby-Doo beat Dawson's Creek to the punch, and one of the recurring jokes throughout the Dawson's Creek episode is, oh, you're making a Blair Witch movie? Hasn't everyone done that? And the fact that when they produced, like, when they wrote that script and acted those lines, they had no way of knowing that literally Scooby-Doo was going to beat to the punch. So that just makes that joke all the sweeter, and now I want to go rewatch the Dawson's Creek Blair Witch episode. But I gotta say, it's not only the marriage of, like, the Scooby-Doo subverting of the expectations of the Scooby-Doo tropes mixed with the subverting of the expectations of the Blair Witch tropes, but it's that marriage between humor and horror that works so well for me here too. I think that's why this edges out the Dawson's Creek episode and all other Blair Witch spoofs, because usually either they're spooky or they're funny, you know what I mean? Like, it's really hard to strike the delicate balance of both, and this does that so wonderfully well. And I want to ask you, Ryan, what is it in your view that makes a good spoof?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think of the best spoofs, which is hard because, again, so many of them aren't good. or at least, like, I think it's got to be within the context of another thing. I would say another work. I think that standalone spoofs are rarely effective. I think probably the most effective standalone spoof is Airplane. Mm-hmm. And I think even people now see that less of a spoof and more of just an absurd comedy, because all the stuff it was spoofing is out of cultural relevance at this point. Like, it, you know, whatever. So what does make a good spoof? I feel like part of it has to be the, like, dynamism of, like, understanding your genre really well. I think if you can call Scream, like, almost a spoof, I guess it's a satire, that's a really good example, because it reconstructs the thing it's making fun of by doing it in some way. which I think makes it quite strong. I know the Scary Movie movies are also popular. I haven't seen them. Not a cinephile at that level, I guess. I'm trying to think of the best spoofs.
It is a hard question. I think that mine personally is probably Spaceballs. I don't know if you've seen Spaceballs. Ooh,
yeah. True.
But I really enjoy Spaceballs. But I feel like an intrinsic part of a good spoof, it's the responsibility of the viewer, in that the viewer, I feel like, has to care about the media being spoofed in order for it to play effectively to them as an audience member. Because, like, I love Spaceballs, but I love Star Wars. And it's not that you have to love the thing, but you have to understand the rigidities of the genre or the media that are being pointed out and laughed at. So I don't necessarily know that I'm saying that you have to love the thing, but you at least have to be, like, fully aware of it. So, like, my sister and my mom, they don't really care for Spaceballs, but they've never seen Star Wars that in-depthly. Now they have, because during quarantine I forced them to watch them. But prior to that, they weren't aware of the incongruity humor that was being presented to them with Spaceballs. And see, I think that's the central component of a spoof to me, is incongruity humor. Like, it has, and in order for the incongruity to work for you on a comedic level, you have to be aware of the rigidities that they are pointing out, you know? Right. So if you don't have an awareness of the expectations, then, like, it just doesn't work for you. And so I think that things that spoof, see, like, another spoof I really enjoy, which I don't know if everyone would categorize this as a spoof, but have you ever seen Mars Attacks?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I love Mars Attacks. And I think that one reason it plays really well to general audiences is because it's spoofing an entire genre, not just, like, one individual piece of media. And so, like, everyone, whether or not you like them, I think almost everyone who has ever sat through a movie has encountered, like, a sci-fi movie that just wasn't up to snuff, you know?
Right.
Like, everyone, especially in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
Like, Hollywood was pumping them out. And so the idea of spoofing an idea or a genre or, like, a cultural phenomenon works really well, I think, rather than spoofing, like, a specific piece of media. And I think that's why Mars Attacks work so well for me, because then you have a larger audience that is aware of the rigidities you are poking fun of.
Yeah. I think one of the difficulties, as I'm thinking of it, is, like, where does the blurred line between satire, parody, and spoof? Because I think satire is different, which is why I think I would even hesitate to call Scream a spoof. It's more of a satire, whereas, like, a Scary Movie is called the spoof. Or, like, a good example, Hot Fuzz is a satire, whereas The Other Guys is a spoof. I think, and now that I think of it, too, have you ever seen, very few people have seen this movie, but I love it, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story?
Yes.
I love that movie. I think it's a fantastic everything, and it's similarly, both of those movies, both Walk Hard and The Other Guys, spoof in the entire, like, genre of their respective genres. And I think that what tilts it is the foregrounding of, like, the complete farcical performance of it. Like, they don't necessarily, they don't demand or want any sort of, like you say, like, congruity within either, like, in the viewer's experience or in their, like, worlds. Like, so Hot Fuzz, for example, like, has a semi-coherent narrative. It makes sense, but it also tells jokes and makes fun of cop movies. But, like, Walk Hard does not make any sense. It's written like a sketch comedy, because it's just, like, new, like, the entire point of everything is to foreground another joke, another thing to make fun of the format that it's looking at. I think that's got to be another dimension of it, which you also see here. It's the and the convenient kind of effect of that is that often the, like, stylistic elements of that genre will turn out pretty well. Like, The Other Guys is a pretty engaging like action movie in addition to being a funny comedy. Walk Hard has really good music. And the Scooby Project is scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think you're right that having some additional component other than just the spoofing, like, add something to the viewing experience. Absolutely.
So yeah, I guess like the best spoofs, again, as I think of them, are, I mean, the most famous is probably Austin Powers is the other one that I have in my mind. But I think that they just get strongest when they, I'm going to retract my previous point. I think maybe TV show based ones can be effective because they're uniting two pieces of media like the Scooby Project is. But generally, I think spoofs come out the strongest when they are broad enough, like you say, draw enough on the experiences of a knowledgeable viewer to consistently be able to make fun of stuff and also have jokes that aren't completely anchored in just the spoofage, if you will.
Right. Well, that's a point that we have to raise when talking about the Scooby Project is like, who was the special made for? Because the Venn diagram of people who had seen Blair Witch in October of 1999 and people who were actively consuming Cartoon Network enough to warrant the expectation that they would sit through a 24-hour Scooby-Doo marathon for this, like, that those have to be two separate circles, right?
Yes. I don't know how they sold this to the executives. What could you have done to make them think that this was, maybe they were just like, you know, whatever, it's I like this, it's fine, it can go in between the Scooby-Doo stuff, and it was just like some over ambitious interns basically who just wanted to do something funny.
But you're right that there's something about this that transcends the need to understand the conventions of Blair Witch in order to appreciate this as the Scooby-Doo Project, you know?
Right.
Like,
because there's so many Scooby-Doo based jokes or just like random funny moments. Like the when Velma's telling the ghost story and Shaggy's like, yeah, we were there. And like, this isn't a ghost story. We were all there. And I think that's just a good one because it's like, it's partially making fun of Scooby-Doo, but it's really just a dumb satire moment more than anything.
Mm-hmm. I want us to each go back and forth and talk about like what we think are the funniest and most meta moments in this special. But before we jump to that, I want to ask you like two final general questions about the genre of, or the nature of the spoof and what this particular spoof represents at the juncture in media in which it was released. So first, like, does this have any business being as good of a spoof as it is? And secondly, how does this one project encapsulate all that was good about Cartoon Network and film media alike at the turn of the millennium?
I will tell you the answers to all these questions. First answer, no, it doesn't have any business being this good. Second answer, much to unpack. I think it's because, again, I don't want to risk being an underinformed historical critic, but I will. It's like the laissez-faire, like, yeah, it's the 90s. It's good. Let's just remix everything. Bah, things aren't, we don't need to worry about things. Ah, bad events, that's another place's problem. It's fine. We're all going to be good. I watched a lot of Beverly Hills 90210, so I think I get a general impression of this attitude. You know, like, oh, there's still problems in the world, but whatever, we'll fix them. And I just feel like that weird kind of primordial soup of culture just permeated a lot of different places and like trickled down into like either really earnest and like earnest attempts to make good television or basically attempts to get good media anywhere it could happen, which is I think why you had like so many shows on, say, Cartoon Network or Nickelodeon that were like really weirdly adult in their theme, or very purposely because they were more like mature cartoons, like whatever, Samurai Jack, or that like drew on stuff where it's like half of like the this is not Cartoon Network, but like SpongeBob SquarePants, half of it was just based in cultural knowledge and references that were completely unfamiliar to children, but yet it was instructive in those things. I don't know. I think it's because the reason it's so good, the reason it encapsulates all this stuff, is because it is that mishmash of like culture colliding into other culture and just rearranging as this like strange shepherd's pie of content.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, that was a great answer, but I'm so hung up on the terminology that you coined there, that primordial soup. Is the primordial soup the soup that we were all bowling for in the late 90s?
Oh, absolutely it was. I mean, that's, what do you think then? Come on. What do you think they named it after? Come on.
So now I do want us, I want us to go back and forth, and we've acknowledged that what makes this so funny of a scary spoof is that it pokes fun at Scooby-Doo. You know, like it, yes. No punches were pulled in terms of meta humor here. And so I want us to each just mention a few of our favorite funny moments or most meta moments from the Scooby-Doo project.
For me, just definitely that one joke I mentioned before, Velma telling the ghost story and Shaggy being like, we were all there. The other one would just be the Scrappy-Doo appearances.
That's the funniest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. When Scrappy-Doo shows up and they all just scream.
Like, right.
It murders me.
It kind of is interesting because it does the thing that the first Scooby-Doo movie like was clearly trying to do, but like hadn't, like didn't earn because it wasn't a good film. Like not earn, but like it didn't pull off because it wasn't good. Like where like Scrappy was the villain at the end of it. Mm-hmm. Which I have to believe that when James Gunn wrote the first Scooby-Doo, he based it. He drew something from this.
Absolutely. James, the greatest influence on James Gunn's screenwriting career is undoubtedly the Scooby-Doo project.
Well, yes. I mean, this is clear. This is known. The oracles have told of this.
but Scrappy-Doo as the villain.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
The idea that nothing is scarier to the gang, like they've been in the woods at Fred, I think it's Fred at one point says they've been there for like a week. But the thing that scares them the most is hearing Puppy Power, spoken aloud in the midst of the forest. That one gets the biggest laugh out of me. Usually another one though, that gets almost as big of a laugh out of me is, and I don't know if this doesn't really count as meta, but it's just the way that the camera lingers on animated Velma after Daphne says, well, at least I try to look feminine. Like there's like a pause, like we just stay on Velma's face for like a full like 4 seconds after that.
And again, it's one of those moments where I'm like, did you do this because you ran out of money and couldn't animate another frame? Was it artistic? Could it be both?
Also, just feel free at any point to jump in and popcorn with me here, Ryan, but I have quite a few moments that I just have to mention. The first being Scooby's pronunciation difficulties being pointed out.
That was great.
When Daphne's like, she said cat. That's what I said. Rat. Like,
I think that's great too, because it's like when you watch it, it's like, or not when you watch it, but it's one of those things where it's, I think what makes it a strong satirical comedy moment is that it's like, wait, yeah, why hasn't that come up before?
Another great one, there's multiple moments throughout that allude to the Fred Daphne dynamic. My favorite of which is when Fred wakes up and he's like, oh, it was just a dream. But I also really appreciate Shaggy at the beginning being like, I'm always stuck with Velma. Like, how come Fred gets to go off with Daphne?
You know, watching, per your recommendation last time, watching Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated, really, it really brings out some stuff, you know?
it really brings out, we have to do, I know this is a movie related podcast, we gotta talk about Mystery Incorporated.
We will. We'll think of it as like a 3 or 4, whatever, 12 hour films.
Uh-huh, exactly. We'll discuss, yeah, we'll couple the episodes together and discuss them as films. Absolutely.
Yes.
Another great joke, which I think might be the best, like, referential moment, is when Shaggy's like, I don't know, man, these woods, they look more real than the woods we're usually in.
Oh, that, I love that one too.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm looking through the Wikipedia article, by the way. Did you write this? Because the plot is like longer than like a short story. It's multi-sentence explanation of every little bit in the thing.
I wish I could take credit for the Scooby-Doo Project Wikipedia entry. It is not one of the Wikipedia entries that I myself have written.
Oh, Jesus.
But I might go contribute to it later. I think that whoever wrote it, though, got almost all of their information from the Reddit thread that I was talking about earlier that I'm going to drop in the show notes, because good. A lot of it comes from that. Another moment that is good, like, let's make fun of ourselves, is when Shaggy's like, this map is just a dotted line and an X.
That was good. I like that one a lot.
In a similar vein, the moment where Fred's like, look at these footprints, and they're animated footprints superimposed over a real ground, and like, those are our footprints.
That was, yes. I wish I could think of, I mean, these are all my favorite moments. They are all my favorite moments. I wish I had more beyond, because these are, I just love them all. I mean, the one that I think twisted my mind the most was when Velma was, like, Velma, there was the thing being chased through the door, and they played the music. And I remember, and they were like, time to get chased.
Velma's like, I hate this part.
Right. And then she just sits back and films. And that's kind of like that eerie story framing thing where it's like, oh, like it is seen this way because Velma's filming it, not because she's participating in like the uh-huh. like the mediation. It's troubling.
I think that's so great when they're like, we always get chased when there's music.
Right.
And then, like, suddenly there are all these doors, and they're like, guess we gotta run through the doors, you know?
Right.
Another great Velma moment is when she's looking for her glasses, and Fred's like, how many times have we told you? A glasses strap!
My girl needs contacts!
This is Velma... Velma honestly is the brains and all, like, she's everything behind Mystery Inc. I will give her credit, but Fred is right. For the smartest person in the world, the fact that she hasn't found a way to not lose her glasses at climactic moments in every episode. Like, let's mm-hmm. let's examine that a little bit.
Velma, you're pathetic. Yeah. Well, okay. So what I found, I think it was like an funny and eerie, was when leading up to that is when they turn on the radio and it's playing that song, which has almost this kind of like they are, but they're just programs in a machine, or like they're puppets being strung along, where they're like there's just the eeriness of that, especially again, I'm listening to the song, or I pulled it up. It's of course from the Scooby-Doo Snack Tracks album, by Austin cool. Roberts. And Danny Jansen. So I just wanted to make mention of that. That's all.
That's all. That's the whole point.
That's it.
I agree though. Like, it is like this eeriness of like, wait, so like they are now aware that they are just cogs in this cartoon machine that like once this button is pushed, they have to respond this way.
Yeah. And normally I really love that kind of like, actually I just do it in this case too. Like, that diegetic kind of quality to any kind of animation or TV show where they like know they're being filmed, and there's this like weird like quote unquote filmed, of course, because they're the other twist is that they're animated. Mm-hmm. But I love that kind of stuff, and it's the fun interaction of that where they like it's not a. It happens on Family Guy once or twice, and I think it happens in other shows that are actually for kids. But it's like where they know they're being filmed, but what they're not like filming a documentary or making something fictional. It's like some merger of like reality TV with their life, which happens to be that. It's just, it was haunting and fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Another moment that to me does that same thing that I briefly mentioned earlier is the moment where Fred is like, but usually within 20 to 22 minutes, we solve it.
Right. Yeah. 20, 22 minutes, we're done.
And he's like, but we've been here for 7 days. And I think that that moment to me is the perfect like marriage between scary and funny, because yes, it is scary because you hear Fred like he sounds terrified.
Right.
But it's, you're like, that's pretty funny that they're pointing out that within their own formula for their show, like always within 22 minutes, everything is resolved.
Right.
And another moment that I can't move on from the whole meta humor thread without mentioning is when they reveal the bad guy to be a human, and he, I can't remember what adjective is used to describe them, but Shaggy says, but he didn't say meddling. Like,
oh yeah, he's like, you intrusive kids or whatever.
Yeah. And Shaggy's like, he didn't say meddling, because that's the most, like, that's the recurring gag of Scooby-Doo to end all recurring gags of Scooby-Doo. You know, like, there's a lot of things that, mm-hmm, are formulated in Scooby-Doo. You know, Fred and Daphne are going to go off on their own. Daphne's probably going to get kidnapped. There's going to be a chase scene that may or may not, incorporate a food court somehow. And the music will be playing over said chase scene. There will be a lot of doors for them to run through. But sometimes each of those may or may not be missing from a given episode, but every episode's going to conclude with, I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you meddling kids.
Yeah. I mean, there's... okay. Yes. There's just... my brain is bursting forth with so many thoughts. Another element that I notice is, like, the... it has the quality of the SpongeBob episode with the gorilla, where, like... Uh-huh. Patrick takes off the gorilla mask and there's two Patricks, and one's wearing, like, actually I think it's quite similar in a lot of ways, because it is like this dimension of just like this unexplained, almost Lovecraftian or Lynchian horror, where it's like you're just terrified by this eerie, unsettling, uncanny thing. Why is it here? And what makes it extra strange in that context is the fact that it's like a real person interacting with like these animated people, but in like not like a Roger Rabbit way, where like, I don't know, he felt like so unsettling and creepy, just his presence there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a lot.
It was a lot. But I've never really thought about the comparisons that could be drawn between the Scooby Project and that specific episode of SpongeBob, but you're right.
Yep. It's just like, oh, it just gives me, it creeps me out.
Mm-hmm. So now, Ryan, I want to ask a question that, you know, we've talked about this as a spoof of Blair Witch, but it is also a spoof of Scooby-Doo, obviously. So why is the Scooby Gang so rife for spoofing?
I think it's because there's so many, by the nature of, I guess, cartoons, especially cartoons of kind of that period, I have to imagine, I think cartoons in general, like, they're modular, right? So, like, they're designed where they, like, do the same thing over and over, because, like, when your budget is $4 and a ham sandwich, as it was in the first Scooby-Doo, like, you don't have the budget or the time to come up with a lot of distinct moments and beats when it comes to, like, a writing thing. So, like, you cycle in a lot of cliches because it won't matter, because it's kids. You might see one of them once in your life, you know, you might see one a million times, or it might get rerun, but like, mm-hmm, reran. But when a kid might see an episode once or never, if even twice, you know, or I guess what, you know what I mean? When they, mm-hmm, see it so infrequently, like, it's probably not economical to spend your time writing it well, or at least writing it organically and freshly each one, so they like have the tropes that like become embedded in and never recognized, And so it's just so easily parodyable where like, it's like, oh, it's always Fred and Daphne because that's an easy pairing to write because it's the same one we've always written. Or this is Scooby and Shaggy being scared, or this is Scooby's dog voice impediment that like is not explained other than the fact that he's a dog. Plus just the strange earnestness of the whole thing. That's what I feel like is just the other combo.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you're absolutely right. I've never really thought about just how like intrinsically linked the formulaic nature of Scooby-Doo probably is to the fact that it had literally zero budget.
Oh yeah. I think that's something that is not to be a theory posting on Maine, but I already have. I think that's just, it's a very fascinating moment of like what Walter Benjamin would call the materialities of production interacting with the work.
Well, now, Ryan, I'm going to ask you a question that I'm totally asking because I myself want to answer it, but I'll let you go first. What do you consider to be the best spoof of Scooby-Doo?
Come back to me. I need to think about this. This is too hard. There, it's too much to chew on. Actually, I lied. Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed is the best spoof of Scooby-Doo. Next.
I was going to ask after you responded initially with like, can we acknowledge that the live action films are spoofs of Scooby-Doo?
Right.
Because they are.
Right. But beyond that, I don't know.
Excluding the live action Scooby-Doo cinematic universe, for those of you who haven't listened to our Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed episode, I don't think anyone that hasn't listened to that has made it this far into this episode because like, why would you? Right. But as I noted to Ryan before we started our discussion that Kayla Murthy has to come up in all of our Scooby-Doo related conversations. And the reason I mention Mr. Worthy is because my favorite spoof of Scooby-Doo is in the season 4 episode. It's like somewhere in the middle of season 4 of Austin and Ally. There's an episode called Mysteries and Meddling Kids, within which the premise is like there's like a school dance that's 70s themed, and so the gang in this case referring to Austin, Ally, Trish, and Dez dress up as the gang from, it's like Funky Goat, something Goat and the Funky Bunch or something like that. Like, I don't know, but it's clearly supposed to be Scooby-Doo. And they each are clearly the Scooby-Doo characters, with Austin being Fred and Ally being Daphne and Trish being Velma and Kayla Murthy as Dez being Shaggy, which also is perfect casting. Kayla Murthy should play Shaggy at some point.
Yes, but I don't want to see his stupid face, but otherwise, yes.
But I love you, Kayla Murthy. It's fine. But what makes that my favorite Scooby-Doo spoof is because there's a recurring joke throughout the episode where everyone says their catchphrases as like the character. And so like this version of Shaggy's catchphrase is like kajoinkers or something like that. But everyone says their catchphrases, and every time it gets to Ally, who is playing the Daphne character, who in this iteration is called Brenda. Well, there are so many levels of spoofing going on here that I'm having to explain. But basically every time it comes to Ally as Brenda / Daphne, her catchphrase is, "Hey guys, it's me, Brenda." And it's just like silence. And every time Allie's like, "Wow, Brenda really needs a better catchphrase." And it murders me every single time I see that episode, which obviously is not more than the normal amount of times.
Not more than once, twice a day.
Exactly. But because I myself have always thought it was kind of weird but funny that like Daphne is the only character that doesn't have a very distinctive catchphrase. You could make the case that maybe Jeepers is her catchphrase, but I don't think so. And that's so similar to Jinkies that it doesn't stand out. And so, you know, Velma has Jinkies, Shaggy has Zoinks, Fred has Let's Split Up Gang. What does Daphne have? It might as well be, "Hey guys, it's me, Daphne."
I feel like that's true because, I mean, I think the metric of it, and I don't remember the Scooby-Doo Scooby-Doo OG, whether it played a Jeepers, but I do know that Scooby-Doo 2 did not feature a Jeepers, which I feel like is pretty significant. Like, if it didn't make it into that, then could it really have? I mean, I do. If I hear Jeepers, I might associate it with Daphne, and I can hear her saying it, but I in my head. But I think that I can't say that it's so familiar that it would be.
Mm. Right. Like if you hear Jinkies or if you hear Zoinks, you're automatically gonna like there's no moment of consideration of would I associate this with Velma and Shaggy. Like it's automatic. And honestly, if I hear anything about splitting up or traps, I'm gonna think of Fred. You know?
Yes, yes, precisely.
Or an ascot. Gotta put that one out there. Isn't
of course
in Scooby-Doo Project where he's like, my favorite necktie or something, and I'm like, dude, it's an ascot.
Right. I'm scrolling through all forms of Scooby-Doo, like I just googled Scooby-Doo parodies and now I'm just looking up different ones trying to find a good one.
I'm telling you guys at home though, if you like Scooby-Doo and you've never watched Austin and Allie, watch Mysteries and Meddling Kids. It'll change your life. It's my favorite Scooby spoof.
Well, this is a twist. There's a Futurama Scooby-Doo, which is probably one of the only Futurama episodes I can remember not having watched. Wow. Okay, so this has got to change.
Interesting. Damn. You need to go watch that one and report back, Ryan. Let us know.
I will.
So, Ryan, I want us to play a sequel to a game we played in our Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed episode.
Let's play a game.
So, we played Scooby Trivia in that episode, and I asked you some pretty specific Scooby-Doo media-related trivia questions, and you did really good.
Yep.
You got almost all of them right, if I remember.
You're damn right I did.
And so now I have gone even deeper into the Scooby lore, if you will.
Yes, into the esoteric codices.
Yes, I have transcended time, space, and spirituality to come forth with these nuggets of Scooby wisdom. And I now want to pose these questions to you and see if you can once again emerge victorious from Scoob trivia. Are you prepared?
I am prepared.
Are you sure?
No. All right, hold on.
I think you're prepared.
Okay, I'm prepared. I just concentrated. Now I'm ready.
All right, you flexing that noodle muscle?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
All right, so first question. This one I expect you to get right, Ryan. From what famous singer's work did the name Scooby-Doo derive?
Frank Sinatra.
Yes, good job.
They sing it in Scooby-Doo too, and now I sing that song constantly. And mm-hmm. Clara asked me, do you just like that song? Do you like Frank Sinatra? And I said, no, I like Scooby-Doo.
I love that, and I can literally picture Clara's face in response to that.
Her raw sadness and disgust.
Mm-hmm. So, second question for you, Ryan. Why did Casey Kasem leave the role of Shaggy in 1997?
That's a good question. Too old. I don't know.
Too old. That's fair. We didn't exist in 1997, but this little piece of trivia blew my mind. He left them because they wanted to use Shaggy in a Burger King commercial. And I'm sorry, Casey Kasem, I might get this wrong. I can't remember off the top of my head if he is a vegan or a vegetarian, but he was like, I don't want Shaggy promoting meat products.
Wow. So good for him.
So he left, and that part of the negotiation to bring him back in the early 2000s was that they canonically make Shaggy a vegetarian.
He is vegan. Yeah, he was vegan, critic of factory farming, supported animal rights and environmental causes, and yeah, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Casey Kasem, if he were still here, would probably like our eventual eating animals episode.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure he would. Thank you, but Casey.
Isn't that hilarious that that's why Shaggy is a vegetarian? I had never before paused to consider why Shaggy would be a vegetarian.
I would have just assumed it was because he was like the crunchiest of them, right. Which I think is funny. like, you know, like Shaggy is like a perpetual hippie. Like Fred is probably like he could go either way. Like he's like a hardcore centrist who is like really happy about voting for Reagan. Like Daphne is the opposite of is not nouveau riche but oldo riche. Velma's kind of like a third way Silicon Valley type who's just really into the crunch and the numbers. Scooby's a Jill Stein voter, you know. But I just pictured Shaggy that way.
Everything you just said was so terrifyingly true.
Oh yeah. Daphne like doesn't really vote ever, but she like has her, she just donates to like the different the RNC and the DNC because it's just like something to write her taxes off for.
Daphne, I feel like Daphne, have you ever seen the Woody Allen movie Everyone Says I Love You?
No.
Okay, well, that may or may not be a good thing. I don't know. But I feel like Daphne's political views are exactly the same as Goldie Hawn's characters in that movie, which is that, like, she was raised really wealthy and married into a really wealthy family. And so she's plagued by this, like, political guilt. But all of her political posturing is, like, strictly performative. Like, she doesn't have any genuine political convictions. It's just like, let me be seen saying that I support like rehabilitation.
She's like Lindsay from Arrested Development.
Yeah. There you go. So we're really unpacking the political convictions of the Scooby-Doo gang.
I mean, we see, just brief aside, in Scooby-Doo Mr. Incorporated, Fred is just more of a local government guy. Anyway, go on.
So my next question for you, Ryan. Which recipient of the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award once voiced a member of the Addams Family for a classic Scooby-Doo episode?
What? I don't know.
You ready?
Yes.
Jodie Foster.
I knew it! Wow.
You did not know it.
No, I didn't know it. What's
so interesting, she was Pugsley Addams, by the way.
What?
What's so interesting about that, though, is that it was Jodie Foster pre-Taxi Driver. Like, she voiced this character in, like, 1972, and then had, like, her huge career breakout in, like, 1976.
How old was she?
When she was Pugsley Addams, I don't know.
She was 10 years old!
But, like, isn't that hilarious, like, crowning achievement of Jodie Foster's career is not the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award. It's not any of her acting accolades. It is the fact that she was in Scooby-Doo in the year of our Lord 1972.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I just feel like this would be like if, like, I'm trying to think of someone who like has a comparable like career trajectory to Jodie Foster. It would be like if I'm sorry, everyone, but this is the best example I can come up with. It'd be like if Natalie Portman, like, we suddenly found out that she had done, like, some voice acting work in, like, 1990 on, like, a little cartoon, you know?
Yeah, it would be like, I'm
trying to think of, like, who's a super serious child actor, like, now that, like, I could say, like, they were on Phineas and Ferb before they became famous.
Right, you know? Or, like, if Brad Pitt had been in the Jetsons.
Right.
Or, I mean, I guess you do kind of see this in some cases where you're like, oh, Leonardo DiCaprio was on Mickey Mouse Club or whatever, or he was the guest star on that one show, or, you know what I mean? Or Zooey Deschanel and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I think, were on Mickey Mouse Club, ?
But the thing that about it, though, that makes it, like, even stranger in this case to me is that, like, Disney is known for launching long-term careers.
That's true.
Cartoon Network, not so much.
Especially not at that point in 1972, when, again, Scooby-Doo was on a... not a good budget. It was not a prestigious prestige drama.
They could not afford Jodie Foster now.
They certainly could not.
Productions.
Go on.
So, next question for you, Ryan. According to A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, on what day does the Blake family count their fortune every week? You have a 1 in 7 chance of getting
Sunday.
Tuesday.
Why?
I don't know. It's so wonderfully weird that I wanted to include that. I don't know. But Tuesday is my favorite day of the week. So I like that.
Of course. Not shocked. It's your red hair, connection.
Exactly. Daphne and I are spiritual sisters. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Daphne, next question. Daphne has sisters named Daisy, Dorothy, Delilah, and Dawn. What is her father's name?
Oh my God. I'm so embarrassed that I don't. This feels like the kind of stuff I would know. Let's see. Dan or Vernon. Those are my two options. Dan or Vernon.
Neither is right.
Damn so, it.
According to the Scooby-Doo Wikia, which I am assuming is right with all of its information, it is Barty Blake.
No! I hate that.
I hate that too, but I was successful in throwing you off with the alliteration.
You did. You were.
Also, speaking of Daphne's parents, you know how in Mystery Incorporated, like, Fred and Daphne are engaged?
Yes, you mentioned that.
Does he ever go to her parents to, like...
Nah.
Not that we have to enforce the patriarchal norm of asking for permission, but, like, since they're in high school, maybe we should see Fred interact with her parents at some point.
Nah, that doesn't matter. Come on. She's only 17. Come on, it's like One Tree Hill. Come on.
It's fine. Wouldn't her parents have to like sign something if they got married in high school? Isn't that how that works?
Not if she emancipates herself, probably.
That should be like a whole like season long arc of the show, Daphne trying to get emancipated.
Right.
And final trivia question for you here, Ryan. Barty Blake shares his voice actor with what other Scooby-Doo role?
Oh, probably Fred.
Is that not the creepiest thing?
Yep, that the Hanna and Barbera, you Oedipal complex creepers. They, of course, being the creators of every Scooby-Doo film. Wow, troubling.
It's so Freudian, I hate it.
It's just because Frank Welker like gets off on voicing multiple different characters and shows. Him and Peter Cullen are like that.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
I wanted to. Is that your final question, or are there more?
That's my final Scoob trivia question for you, Ryan.
Okay, I'm going to turn the tables on you. I was looking because you mentioned Addams Family. It ignited. It's spooky season, of course. I was watching Addams Family Values, which is one of my favorite movies, or like a perfect movie, the other day. And I want to ask you Addams Family cast trivia. Are you familiar with any of the Addams Family movies?
Yes, I have seen them. I'm not as fanatical in my approach to the fandom as you, Ryan, but I am aware of them.
Well, clearly not. Well, okay, so this is your choice then. Would you like Easy Mode, which is a quiz about Addams Family Values? It will be probably two questions long. Or do you want a quiz about the direct-to-video sequel, Addams Family Reunion, which had none of the same cast except for, I believe, one?
Absolutely, Addams Family Values.
Disappointing.
I know. I'm sorry. I'll have you back on, and we'll do an episode on the direct to video sequel. Okay.
I understand. Okay. Well, shoot. This is hard. okay. It'll just be the one question.
Okay. I'm terrified.
Okay, you know what, too? Do you know what now famous adult actor made her breakout role in The Addams Family and its sequel before becoming a teen icon?
A teen icon?
According to Wikipedia.
According to Wikipedia, a teen icon. See, that's, I don't know what we define as teen icon.
A famous teen actor.
A famous teen actor who was in Addams Family Values. Okay, were they is their character named, or are they just like...
They are named, yes.
Well, it's just like none of the main cast, none of them would I consider... Just tell me, Ryan.
Well, it was Christina Ricci as Wednesday Addams, of course.
I know that she's Wednesday Addams. Is she really a teen icon?
According to Wikipedia, she was.
According to Wikipedia, okay. Who wrote that Wikipedia entry?
the Ricci Corp Incorporated. Big Ricci.
Exactly. I'm like, I don't think, was it? Was wait. This, she's in like Speed Racer, right?
Yeah, she's the girl in Speed Racer.
She's not a teen icon. Anyone who appeared in Speed Racer is not an icon. I'm sorry.
Well, fine. Okay. But let me ask you one question about Adam's family reunion anyway. Okay. So it's really just a guessing game. Which future star or cast member on Kill Bill appeared in Adam's family reunion? Are you familiar with Kill Bill?
Yes, I'm familiar. I'm more familiar with Kill Bill than I am Adam's family reunion.
Yeah, evidently.
I straight up have no idea who
Wait, let me confirm that this is her. Okay, it is. Well, of course, it's Daryl Hannah as Morticia Adams.
Wait. Daryl Hannah plays Morticia Adams?
Yes, she does. And do you know who she played opposite? Well, it's a little actor by the name of Tim Curry as Gomez Adams.
Okay, I can remember Tim Curry in that role, but I just, Angelica Houston just so dominates my, like,
well, as she should.
Dear Lord.
I'm going to name just one final piece of trivia. And again, I like this trivia because it's not really trivia. It's just like me telling you things that you don't know about this movie. Do you know who was the, I'm going to confirm this. I want to say it was like the one, oh, Michael Jackson was involved in the movie. Wow. Oh no, that's just a rumor. Sorry. That's unrelated. Let me confirm this. Character was reprised by the same person between Adam's Family Values and Adam's Family Reunion?
Do I just have to tell you the character? Or
yes, because I don't think you'd know the act. I don't know the actor.
Okay.
If you can guess one actor who played, well, one character who played the same actor in between both.
I'm just gonna throw out an Addams Family character that I feel like this, like, I don't know, Lurch.
Actually, Lurch was one of the two, so good job. The other one was Christopher Hart's hand as Thing.
That counts.
That is how the Wikipedia article is written. Cast. Patrick Thomas is Uncle Fester, Carol Stricken, who also plays the giant from Twin Peaks as Lurch, Christopher Hart's hand as Thing.
I hate that. This is over, Ryan. No more trivia
now,
for you.
Now, you might be wondering, has he ever played any other hands? In fact, he has played other hands. He played the hand in the film Idle Hands. And in the film Angel, he played the hand.
Okay. This is like, I don't know if you remember this, but do you remember there was like a recurring sitcom joke, like across lots of different shows in like the late 90s, early 2000s, where like people wanted to be hand models? Like that just like yes. was a thing for some reason. And like yes. obviously there's the Friends episode with the identical hand twin, but I remember so vividly. Do you remember that show Saved by the Bell?
Do I remember Saved by the Bell?
Wait. No. I'm sorry. I'm dumb. Not Saved by the Bell. What's the Disney one that, As the Bell Rings.
I wish that
this was a Saved by the Bell moment because I like Saved by the Bell much more. But, As the Bell Rings, which launched the career of little known actress singer Demi Lovato, there was an episode where they were having a talent show and the like dumb blonde trope character like didn't have a talent. She was like, I'm gonna be a hand model.
Wow.
And that's just we are so off topic now, Ryan.
Send you off screen. You can put it in the show notes if you want. I'm ignoring what you're saying about us being off topic because I'm sending you a 20-minute documentary about Christopher Hart. Quote, perhaps best known in the film world as Thing, the Disembodied Hand, and Adam Stanley Values, this documentary explores his career and the challenges of playing a variety of characters in film and television using only his hands.
Nice.
I'm taking your silence as
endorsement. I will watch it and report back.
Please.
Fine. Consider it. A silence does not equal endorsement is going in my Twitter bio as soon as we're done with this.
Yeah. That's relevant for that.
Yeah. So, Ryan, I feel like it's time that we begin wrapping up this conversation. And
what?
So
we've only been talking for 2 hours.
About a 20-minute television special. So I want to offer you, as we wrap up, I want to ask you this question because I feel like I would be remiss to record this episode with you without asking this, since this is a film-related podcast, and we've discussed this because this, though it's a television special, is spoofing an iconic spooky film. Something you and I have made mention of in the past, both on the podcast and off, when discussing Scooby-Doo, is the notion of like a Scooby-Doo cinematic universe, and how we appreciate the fact that Scooby-Doo films are all episodic in nature. Like, it's kind of like the Scooby-Doo canon is like an anthology of sorts, you know, like there's not necessarily continuity or relation between these different film installments. But apparently, which, you know, we haven't done a Scoob episode, maybe one day, but apparently Scoob was originally intended to be the first foray into the Hanna-Barbera cinematic universe. Like, this is a thing that Hanna-Barbera wants to make now. So I just want to know, Ryan, what are your thoughts on a cinematic Scooby-verse? And do you think that that could be a good thing, or do you prefer the lack of continuity amongst Scooby projects?
That's Scooby projects, as they're known. That's a good question. I feel like I like the episodic nature of it. I think that it, or at the very least, like serialized, I think it contributes to the sort of mythic narrative of Scooby-Doo. And I think that while I like, I think it's cool that Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated does persistent continuity within, and like long form storytelling within itself. I think that like you're just having your cake and eating it too with a Scooby-Doo cinematic universe. Not to mention that like, what will that accomplish besides having a bunch of the same WB properties within like the same animation style, which is effectively the same thing as all the Illumination Dr. Seuss stuff, which I don't like. I haven't seen Scoob. I really like the voice cast, but I've heard it might not be clever enough to support that. But I do know that like Captain Caveman, Dog Wonder, who's the other, Muttley, all those boys are in it. So like, for the sake of the mythos, really, the mythology, shouldn't we keep Scooby-Doo episodic? That's what I have to say.
I agree. I think that the Scooby-verse is vast and as nuanced as it is. So like, why do we need to fix something that's not broken? You know.
I think if anything, the fun of it is the contradiction, the internal tension of the fact that like you want to be able to draw continuity between it and yet you can't.
Exactly.
You know, like that's the dynamic kind of the tension that fuels it, I would say.
Right. And I feel like that was an important thing for us to address, considering we started this conversation by talking about what makes Zombie Island so special is that it's different. You know, as a kid, when you watch Zombie Island, you're like, oh, this isn't my childhood Scooby-Doo. This ain't your mama's Scooby-Doo, because it's different in how we approach the characters. And we didn't see the build up to that point. There's no continuity, you know, like it's not like there was a movie where they all went to college and went their separate ways. And Daphne began a television career and Fred became her cameraman and all that good stuff. Like it is what it is, and it exists. That version of the Scooby-Doo characters exists solely within the context of Scooby-Doo and Zombie Island, you know, and that's what makes it work.
You know, and I think that it you can even unite it within like the same animation style. Like I kind of think of the Scooby-Doo stuff that comes out of the like from Zombie Island, all those like the Scooby-Doo movies of that period, basically. and into the mid sort of 2000s with What's New Scooby-Doo. Like, just because they're of a vaguely similar animation style, I think they lead themselves to be read that way anyway, but I think that they're each individually effective because they don't demand any kind of like continuity, which is why like Scooby-Doo Cyber Chase is so fun, because it deals with like oh, this is old Shaggy with the red shirt, and like this is everybody, like, and because
this is every monster we've ever faced.
Yeah, the fun of it is the way that they respin it, and the way that they, because like that wouldn't, ironically, it wouldn't work in a one where it was a cinematic universe, because it would be like, oh yeah, like of course that's how they used to dress. Like, I mean, I guess Avengers Endgame kind of does that, but like it's even more effective. I'm gonna say it's Scooby-Doo Cyber Chase better than Avengers Endgame.
Wait, I literally, I just, when you said that, I was like, the scene where the different versions of the Scooby Gang interacted, like where they enter the video game, like that. That walked so that the portal scene in Endgame, well, that it ran, the Scooby-Doo scene ran so that the portal scene in Endgame could crawl.
Yes, that's right. And I think that, you know, say what you will about the garbage about that low art Avengers Endgame, but I think that the high art of Scooby-Doo, the kind of Rembrandt-esque tapestry that it is, I think that is fun because it's doing this like quirky thing of tying together different continuities, but it doesn't demand anything going forward from you. Also, like, are you trying to, like, to what end do you make a Scooby-Doo cinematic universe? Like
what is the purpose? Also, like, it would disturb the firm foundation upon which all Scooby-Doo narratives have been built, because the nature of Scooby-Doo is that Fred and Daphne are perpetually locked in will they, won't they. Like,
yes.
And like, you know, we talked earlier, we don't like to watch things before the couple gets together, but like if Fred and Daphne ever got together, it would disturb the fabric of the universe.
Yes. Know? That's kind of the fun. Number one, that's kind of why you can only really do it like once. Like, you can only do that in Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated. You can't do it again at this point. And then on top of that, you know, my rage, you know, is so untethered here. But I think that's like the exact mythic narrative thing. Like, it's very asymptotic, like to be a math nerd about it. It's always the entire thrust of Scooby-Doo is that you're always approaching the Daphne and Fred singularity, but you never find it. The characters always seem to be getting a little bit older, but yet they never truly age. Like, that's the kayfabe, the professional wrestling element of it.
Yeah, and it's like it reminds me of Nancy Drew. Like,
yeah,
when I pick up a Nancy Drew book, she needs to be 18. Like, she cannot age beyond that. The Scooby-Doo gang, I need, just like when I pick up the book, I want to encounter Nancy in that version. Like, I want to encounter the Scooby-Doo version, like, as I am comfortable with them. I don't want to be forced outside of that.
Yes, do not force me out of my comfort zone, media, if you try, if you even try. No, right, that's true, though. I think that there's a very solid element to me and why some of my favorite shows are, like, Futurama, is because as much as I like character development in some things, like, there's just a nice feeling when you look at it and you're like, the only thing that has changed is the quality of the animation. And again, why do you need a universe? What does that do for you?
Because Marvel has done it. That's why everyone is trying to have their own, like, cinematic universe right now.
What could you even accomplish with it besides the wacky racers, the wacky racers as the Avengers culmination?
Ryan, I don't know. I don't think it's a good idea. Please, Hanna-Barbera, do not do this to us.
Now, there's no update on whether it is actually leading into a cinematic universe based on Hanna-Barbera properties, which is interesting.
Right, but that was the original conception. So I think what threw it off, though, is that it didn't get a theatrical release, so they couldn't really monitor how the public was responding. But listen to us. This is the public response. We don't need it.
Plus, this makes sense. I see how this has happened. I think that they were going to call it the Scooby-Doo Cinematic Universe because of what it was originally intended. So at 2016 at CinemaCon, cool, the film's official title was announced to be Scoob, S.C.O.O.B. like S.H.I.E.L.D., with a plot involving Scooby-Doo and the Mystery Machine Gang working for a larger organization. Basically, they join the military-industrial complex. And so that would kind of make sense for why it would have, like, how it would be that. Like, they wouldn't have directly included Blue Falcon or whatever. They would have just mentioned him. But at this point, this is already... This, how can you, you can't kickstart a cinematic universe. This movie is the Warner, the Hanna-Barbera cinematic universe. Like, it's got Dick Dastardly. It's got D.D. Sykes. It's got Dino Mutt and the Blue Falcon. It's got Captain Caveman. I guess there's no Jabberjaw, but that's probably the one exception.
Yeah, it's, yeah. I agree with you, Ryan. That's the point of, like, what made the Marvel Cinematic Universe actually earn its payoff was the fact that it built to the bringing together of all the characters.
Right.
So, let's move away, because I can sense your rage, Ryan.
My rage. I am untethered, and my rage knows no bounds.
So, and also I want to keep this, there's no reason this conversation should be a 2-hour conversation about a 20-minute television
show. Unless.
My final question for you, Ryan, is should this special be released on DVD and or rebroadcast? And then my, as always, my wrap-up question, is this piece of media worth a rewatch?
Worth a rewatch? Yes. Worth releasing on DVD? I say no. Not because of its quality, but because if they released it on DVD, then it would, I think, you would lose the... it would lose its urban legend kind of power. Mm-hmm. If it's going to go on DVD, I think it should only be for the purpose of basically preserving it in perpetuity. But you can just do that by doing www.youtube.mp4.com, converting the video into an MP4 and then saving it.
That's what all the true fans should do.
True fans, if you're out there, tell YouTube to MP4 that I sent you there and that they owe me money.
I cannot believe, Ryan, what we have turned this conversation into. But yes. Also, I can totally believe it. So,
yeah.
Congratulations if any listeners have made it this far, aka Mary.
Congrats, Mary. You did it.
Ryan, do you have anything else you want to say in wrap-up before we officially close this episode dealing with the Scooby-Doo project out?
Watch Scary Godmother. Watch Scooby-Doo. Come back to me with your thoughts. Make me a film influencer.
Make me a film influencer. All right. All right, Ryan. Thank you so much for being here. I love our in-depth Scooby-Doo discussions.
Me as well. Me as well. Of course. Thank you for having me.
All right. So as always, if there are films you would like to hear discussed, don't hesitate to reach out. You can find the podcast with the handle Play It Again, Kyla, on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And you can find me personally at Kyla_Z_Percival. This has been Play It Again, Kyla. I am your host, Kyla Percival, signing off and saying I voted for Andy Kaufman.